From the campus of the University of Hawaii, this is the Center for Southeast Asian Studies Lecture Series Podcast. Podcasts, video streaming, MP3 downloads, and more are available at hawaii.edu/CSEAS and at iTunes.
Welcome, everyone. Thank you for joining us for our almost weekly brown bag on Southeast Asia topics. We're very grateful for Dr. Will McClatchy from the Department of Botany to come and join us today. We're particularly excited because of our growing interaction with botany and some of the other physical sciences. And we look forward to a course that Dr. McClatchy will be teaching in the botany of the Mekong. I think that's what we've decided it's going to be called. Something like that. Spring 09. So for those of you who are still hanging on at that time, please consider joining us. Dr. McClatchy's research addresses the hypothesis about the evolution of patterns of human interaction with plants and ecosystems. While his past research was largely conducted in South and Western Pacific region, we're quite pleased that he's decided to join the Southeast Asia sphere. He's studying the relationship between patterns of human knowledge of biodiversity and actual biodiversity. Today's topic, a question of scale, where is biodiversity within a hotspot? Thank you.
Okay. So I'm going to run through several different things, and so this is kind of my outline, just in case it becomes confusing why I just suddenly jump from one topic to the next. First, I'm going to say a few things about how people see plants and kind of use myself as an example. Then I'm going to talk about differences in scales between the way that people see plants and the way science generally is viewing plants right now and the disjunct that's there. I'm then going to give an example which will take up most of this talk, which is some research that we did last year in Northeast Thailand. And then I'll conclude with a few statements about the projects that we have ongoing right now in our research group. So, Thailand. No, Arizona. So I'm taking it here because I can share a story that I hope you'll be able to relate to. When I was a new graduate student, I didn't know anything about plants. I came in with an anthropology degree, so I was coming from out of left field. And my professor took me out to learn about plants, and he took me into southern Utah and northern Arizona. And he would drive like a bat out of hell in his truck, and we'd go flying down these dirt roads, and then suddenly he would slam on the brakes, and he'd back up, and he would look at some plant, and he would, and then drive on, and I'm sitting in the seat thinking I'm driving with a crazy man. And then every once in a while we would stop after that little routine, and he would get out and stomp over, and we would look at some plant, and then he would start talking about it. And after doing this for a few days, and thinking, you know, why didn't I go into something else? My professor's a psycho. It started to become clear what he was doing, and then he started to teach me about the plants. And the process that I learned was that the way that a botanist learns, and this is probably the way any human learns plants, is you learn one plant. You start to understand that one. And then you learn another and another. And he was driving like crazy, and in his head he's saying, oh, I know that. He's calling out names in his head, boom, 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 boom. And then he'd see something that didn't make sense, and he'd go and check it out. And so he knew enough of the diversity that he could spot the holes and see something odd, something new. Now, obviously, nobody begins at that point. You ramp up to that point. Okay, what do you see when you look at that picture? A bunch of green. But if you start to learn, you'll see, here's this one tree. I'll learn a name. I'll put a tag on that. And I can actually start to recognize that. And as I walk through the forest, I can consistently spot that tree again and again where I see it. When you pick up the second one, you're actually as much learning between the two and saying, okay, this one is different from that one because of this. In this case, I've got a little herbaceous plant, I've got a tree, but there's obviously much more involved in that. And this process obviously continues. You go, oh, aha, well, there's actually two of this other tree in there. I can see them there. And we could pick our way through and draw this all crazy. And this is the process by which somebody learns plants. And I think it's not just true of botanists, it's true of people in any culture. You learn them, and you have to begin somewhere. It's hard to convince new students of this. But it turns out once you have a handful in your pocket and you're comfortable with them, then you start doing what my crazy professor did, which is look for the things you don't recognize. They start standing out, and you then start to add those to your repertoire. So it's this simple process. Okay, this is the scale at which humans learn about biodiversity. Okay, there's some scales at which humans don't learn about biodiversity, but at which science acts quite heavily right now and pumps most of its dollars into. So kind of this satellite view scale. So here's Southeast Asia. Okay, where's the biodiversity? Well, that's a very good question. If you don't know any better, you'd say, oh, it must be where it's all green. But that's not true. Bad assumption. Okay, I'm zooming in a little bit. Can I see it now? Can I tell where is the biological diversity? Is it here? Is it there? Where is it? I don't know. But this is the scale at which science is mostly operating right now. Well, we can produce some maps like this. This is kind of a nice one that tells me, oh, these are different kind of categories of diversity. Somebody went around and measured pixels and then said, oh, this pixel seems to be like this thing that we encounter on the ground, so let's call all those pixels that thing. Here we go. These are great. But it still doesn't tell me where the actual plants are at and what's there. Okay. All right. Shifting gears now. So we've got these big maps where people have said, okay, these are going to be our priorities worldwide. So I've got the language one on here too, since I knew there was a bunch of linguists today. So this is the only language thing you're going to get thrown at you. we have these places that have been identified as biodiversity hotspots. And it's partly political as to why they were identified, but it's also fortunately partly biological. They're places that happen to have known high levels of endemism, unique plants and animals. And they're also ones that are thought to be threatened for a lot of different reasons. And so all the little green areas on there are areas that are identified as biodiversity hotspots, and they're areas where research money is being focused. Well, those are still huge areas. How do we know where in one of those areas biodiversity is at? So for instance, this is the Indo-Burma biodiversity hotspot that includes all of this. So maybe I should go to downtown Bangkok to find... No. You know, where do I go? Well, so if it just so happens that our field site is in the middle of this biodiversity hotspot, where that little star is. We picked it for other reasons that I can go into later, but I happen to notice this after the fact. And so this particular biodiversity hotspot is thought to have a little more than 7,000 endemic plant species, but we really don't know because the botany is fairly weak in the area. So this is where we worked, that I'm going to go into in a minute. So here's Lao, Thailand, northeast Thailand, Sikonikon province, and then we worked in this small area down here, and we worked with Phu-Thai communities. These are Lao language group, or Thai-Lao, however you want to call that. They call themselves Laotians, but their language is Phu-Thai. This is the area in which we worked. So this is the Mekong up here. Lao is off the edge of the map up there. And in the foreground, this is a small mountain range and a lake. And this area is really good for being able to do the kind of research question that we were asking for a couple of reasons. One is we've got this nice pocket of a cultural group who's living actually next to two things that we would normally predict would have interesting biological diversity. So a lake is a nice margin, and a mountain is a nice margin, and that's where we should have interesting biological diversity. And so, if you were standing on top of this mountain and looking off, this is what you'd see. Is you'd see forest in the foreground right here at the edge, and then going out across there, there's a broken up plain. This is a dry dipterocarp forest that was originally probably cut open as Sweden, and now it's extensive rice fields with a lot of the forest removed. If you're at the edge of one of those rice fields and you're looking back at that mountain, this is what you see. It looks like nice, pretty fall colors, but it's not. That's all trees that are in flower. So we chose to work there during the time of year that the vast majority of the plants are flowering so that we could actually identify them. Okay. The community that we're working with there, this is actually one of my co-authors, Pia. The community is the rice farmers, mostly growing sticky rice, glutinous rice. And until fairly recently, they were self-sufficient in everything they needed. Obviously, they're bringing in plenty of trade goods now, and they export all kinds of things. Here's one of my other co-authors here, Dr. Bridges, smiling about his find. Other biological diversity. Yeah. Which he can tell you is not very good wine. But lots of diversity there that's not just the forest diversity. It's things that people are moving around, plants and animals, things like that. So I'm going to show you four steps in the research that we did. So, and this was our primary question, which is, are human communities sensitive to differences in biodiversity? So I showed you that map. It actually, I don't think I pointed it out, it had a whole bunch of dots on it that are different villages. So our question is if we look across the spectrum of villages, who some of them are close to places that have high biological diversity, some of them are probably far from them, can we detect a pattern in what they know? Are they going to be sensitive to the relative differences in biological diversity that's around them? Okay, so this is the district where we worked. And the first step that we did was we went and met with the district leaders, and they have incredible records. And one of the things that they had was they had a map that basically showed the ethnicity of everybody in the communities within the district. And so they identified that these villages that are in black were communities that only had people who were Hutai, and the other villages are ones that have people from other cultural groups that have come in. Mostly other people from Isan areas nearby. Once we did that, then we went and met the mayors of each of those villages and provided them with some information about our project and asked them if we went through the normal informed consent process, asking if it was okay to come there, and asked the mayors if there was a time in the future where we could come and conduct some ethnographic interviews and also come and do some botanical surveys in their area. The mayors were asked then to also line up a set of families from their village who we could interview. So they were actually the people who selected the informants. At the time, I was working at Konkan University in the Faculty of Pharmacy, and I had a class of senior pharmacy students. So all of these guys are off now practicing as pharmacists. And what we did was, for our field work in my course, we went up to that field site, and so I trained them in how to do the ethnographic interviews and how to go out and collect the plants. And so that's what they did for their course project. So it's their data I'm showing you, largely. So the first thing that we did was we came in and we conducted interviews within each of the villages, and these were set up so that in each community we had a spectrum of people we were interviewing. We had children, we had people who had children, and we had grandparents, people who had grandchildren. And in most cases, these were all from the same family unit. The idea being that their knowledge should be overlapping between the three generations. But we interviewed them separately. So we interviewed groups of children, and we interviewed groups of adults, and we interviewed groups of grandparents. And it was a simple free-listing exercise. Name every plant you can think of. It just doesn't get any easier than this. Tell us the name. And so they would take these little bits of paper and start writing down Hutai names, and sometimes they put in an Isan name or a Thai name. And this made a nightmare for us to figure out later, but we did it. So there were at least three, sometimes four languages involved. But fortunately, it was all written in the same script. And the group would decide on the names, and then they were trying to come up with a stack of these. And then we did several other things to try and increase the number of names that they came up with. All of that took place in a very short period of time. Most of those interviews took about 3 hours, and that's kind of a key point in this. So in a 3-hour period, we would interview a group of people, gather this block of data, and it's not a complete block of their knowledge. And I can show you why in a minute, but it's a sample that's pretty consistent across all of these communities. So here's some examples of some of the groups that we interviewed. Okay, the next step we did was we worked within each community with parataxonomists. We ran transects out from the villages, and we basically collected the diversity of plants all around these communities out to the distance that they would normally travel. So if they went off to a temple somewhere, if they went off to their field somewhere, we would go that far. And so we collected plants in all kinds of interesting places. So here's that woodlot you saw earlier, happens to be in one of those villages. Lots of plants in the communities. And interestingly, one of the very fertile places was plants in temple areas. And that's oftentimes where people would take us. They'd say, oh, well, you gotta come get them over here because that's where we put all the interesting things. And the home gardens also had lots of interesting plants. Botanically, what we identified was that there were two areas, and this was kind of predicted a priori, that had high biological diversity, several deviations from the norm. One is the slope of the mountain that was to the southwest, and the other is along the edges of the lake, the wetlands that surround the lake. There was also an area identified that had really low biological diversity because it's mostly converted to rice fields. So you've got a few weeds in the ditches, and every once in a while a little piece of a woodlot, but not a whole lot other than that. And so if you look at the map, so here's the villages scattered. We have an area out here that's really low biodiversity, and then an area along this lake, and an area along the front of the mountain that are high. Is that straightforward? Okay, nothing complex there. Okay. We then did another step that I'm not going to get into today, but it's kind of interesting, which is we took all of those plant specimens that we collected and sat down with different individuals in the community, went around to the villages, and interviewed people, asking them about the plants, opening them up, showing them, asking them the name, what do you call this thing, and connecting the data back. Because when we did the initial free listing, people weren't running out and grabbing the plant and saying, oh, this is what it is right here. So we were able to connect the data back to the specimens. But oftentimes people would start going on and on about all the uses of a particular plant. That wasn't really our goal, but anybody who's done this kind of work knows what happens. It's kind of this little download mode that people get into. They start telling you everything about it. Sometimes that was done with individuals, but most often it was done with groups of people. So here's a family sitting down and going through a stack of specimens, and we had just thousands of these. And so it would take most of the day for somebody to go through a stack. At the end, we took those specimens and made them into mounted vouchers like this and put the information that we had learned onto labels. This is all in Thai. And deposited these in a set of cabinets that we built and put in the local high school. And so this is the high school principal when we were delivering these. So basically, everything we learned in that community is sitting in that community where they can go back and reference it themselves. And then we typed up our results as well. This is kind of what our basic data looked like. So we'd have a collection, some information of names in the different languages, and then our scientific identification of the specimen. We also had lots of photos that we took of the plants as we were going along. In total, there were a little more than 2,600 taxa that were identified. I'm not going to go into what this is saying, but just so you know, there was lots of plants there. So it's a relatively high diversity area, even though we're out in a dry forest site. So on the map, the big satellite map we looked at, this area would have looked brown. So, and yet it's got very high diversity relative to many places on there that look green. If we look at a distribution of the interviews, the highest that any group gave us was, I think, 380-something. Was it up there? I don't have it up there. Names. Lots of overlap in the names, but also lots of unique things would come out. where one community might know some things and another community wouldn't even mention those. Lots of funny things in the data, too, that I can get to if we have time at the end. So if you take that data and spread it out across the group of communities, and this is an average of the three groups in each community, so the children, the adults, and the grandparents, we can see that we have a distribution where they're not all coming up with the same amount. And so red here means high and yellow means low in this particular color coding as far as the number of taxa that they identified in a short period of time. So here's our data. And what we want to do is take this data and map it back onto all these communities that are spread out across the landscape. So here's our map again, now looking down on it. So if we take that map and plot those on there, and then what we've done is we've created a knowledge map that's basically contours of knowledge. So this is one of the higher villages, had more knowledge reported, and so are these two, and so is these ones along here, particularly that one. And so we then, as we look at them in relationship to each other, as if they were altitudinal points, we can then create a hypothetical map of the knowledge distribution across the environment. Now, we didn't interview anybody out here, so this is an artifact of this construction, but it says that knowledge is moving up as you go in this direction and should continue to go up. So maybe if there was some little hermit out here, this person would theoretically know more. I don't know. So what does this mean? Well, the mountains happen to be right over here. The lake happens to be right here. And out here is that area where they're primarily just growing rice. And so to me, this says that people who are not being exposed to a lot of diversity around them, just in a fairly small area, versus people who are potentially exposed to a lot of diversity, have differences in their levels of knowledge, at least as they report in a fairly short period of time. It's kind of right on the top of their thinking. So if we put this, if we overlay this on the map, we can see it even a little better. So here's our area out here where botanically we found high diversity. Here's our area along the mountain where botanically we found high diversity. And you notice the correlation here of knowledge. And likewise, there's this reverse process out here where there was low diversity that we found, but as botanists, there was also low diversity reported by the adjacent communities. The interesting little aberration is this dot right here, and it turns out that next to this community is the kind of the cultural center where there's a big Wat, and we did, in several of these around here, we did interview the monks who were part of it, and the abbot came and joined the conversation at one of those groups, so it's probably artificially jacked up because of intellectuals. There's a recent paper published looking across the United States on another track, that shows that the floristic diversity in the United States is highest around universities that have a botany program. And I think that's this exact same effect right here. A little pocket of guys who are keeping track of more stuff than the average person wants to. Okay. All right, so what's our conclusion? Our conclusion to this is that people are sensitive to very local biodiversity differences. So if we came in and actually to survey all of those villages took us 2.5 days. So in a 2.5 day period, we were able to measure a fairly large area and do it fairly easily with a really simple tool. I mean, it's so simple a botanist can use it. You know, it doesn't take a professional ethnographer to get it clean, I hope. And we came out with a data sample that's reproducible and shows us, okay, here's where the micro biodiversity hotspots should be. And botanically, we confirmed that. Okay, so that's valuable. So we've got a set of projects that we're working on now. One of them is we're looking at kind of the big scale in the Mekong region of where is biocultural diversity distributed and what's the nature of it. There's actually no flora, for instance, of Lao. There's kind of some old bits and pieces of the flora of Indochina, but there's no modern flora that tells us what the plants are. And there's even purported to be cultural groups there speaking languages that aren't documented. So that's your area in Egypt. So lots of diversity going on, lots of people interacting with the environment, and very little knowledge about how that all kind of fits together. We're particularly interested in what's happening because of climate change. Climate change is basically going to cause a lot of these people to have to move because they're not going to be able to earn a living in the exact same places where they are. And so in the process of trying to describe and circumscribe where they are at now and what they're doing, as they shift, hopefully we're going to learn something interesting about the patterns of how people interact with the environment. Many of these cultures, of course, have shifted in the past, and so we've got some interesting questions we're asking about that as well. We're also wanting to map these micro hotspots, so if we can plop ourselves down in multiple places and use this method that I just showed you, how quickly can we put together some more finely tuned maps about where biodiversity is actually located. Right now, biologists are kind of patrolling across the whole region, which is ridiculous. It really needs to be honed down a lot faster. And then lastly, we're interested in looking at Swidden biodiversity and taxonomy. I'm going to kind of go into that for a second here. So if we look at the whole watershed, this is kind of the characteristics of the watershed that is the Mekong. It's quite different than the adjacent watersheds on either side, in that there's actually not really any huge cities in here besides Phnom Penh. Bangkok is outside of this, and the various Vietnamese cities that are huge are outside of this. So it's an interesting watershed. Most watersheds have at least one giant city in them. This one doesn't have any. It has nine that could be called large, but they're cities that you can physically walk across. So when I was living in Phnom Penh is one of them. It's not that big. Relatively low population density, but it's distributed fairly evenly, particularly, and a lot of it's concentrated out here in the Korat Plateau and in Cambodia. But this is the interesting feature to me, is the forest cover, and it depends on who you talk to as to what this number is. But I tried to get a consistent source for these numbers. So forest cover of around 40%, which means that for that whole region, this is a biodiversity hotspot, most of the forest cover is in this watershed. It's not in the adjacent areas that are over here and over here. It's in this. And the big thing that's important to us is that the people who live here, since they're not in cities, they're largely dependent upon agriculture, and there's a particularly high proportion of them that are dependent upon Swidden agriculture, which is a big concern. When we had meetings with the Laotian government discussing our research, this was the key thing that they said they wanted us to focus our work on, was analysis of Swidden systems. We can look at the river as consisting of three areas, and people have chopped this up in different ways, but for us, biologically, this is a good way to divide it, because there's a big difference between the biodiversity up here. So when we visited up in areas along up in here last year, these are rhododendron forests, pines, things like that. It just does not look like it. And here we've got dipterocarp forests, and then down here we have lowland Southeast Asian jungle. And there's also big areas of dry plateau in here. So, and the effect of rainfall on these three different areas is very different as well. So this is how we're kind of breaking it up. So the first aspect of our big scale research is we are looking at what I'm calling a mega transect. So starting up here at the source of the Mekong in Tibet and going all the way down to the delta in Vietnam. And one piece of what we're wanting to do is to produce these gigapan photos. Is anybody familiar with these? Am I repeating it? It's okay. This gigapan technology is something developed by NASA that uses a robot like this. And so we've got one of these robots, you hook a camera into it, and the camera proceeds to take a series of high-density photographs that are then stitched together, and you can create a massive photo. This is not a megabyte thing, this is billions and billions of bytes. This is a Sagan number. And And the key thing of it is, so this is one, Rick Palmer is the one who's working on this with us. This is a photo he took from the top of in Waianae, looking out into Makaha. And if you look at the actual Gigapan photo, if you go online to Gigapan and look up his name, Richard Palmer, you can find all of his photos, or if you just put in Hawaii, you'll find a whole bunch of his photos. And if you go to one of those photos and you start to zoom in, you can zoom in on trees out here and see them. So we want to be able to have along the Mekong a set of overlapping Gigapan photos so that we can actually monitor the biodiversity, not just at the level of a blurry photo, but at the level where we can actually go in and get usable detail, information that's, you know, of value. And this is not just monitoring the biodiversity, but if we're also monitoring the cultural diversity. He also has some on there that show like Waikiki. And he's taking it from Diamond Head, and you can zoom in and see individual people quite clearly sitting on the beach. You know, and they have no idea that there's, you know, Big Brother's watching them from Diamond Head. So, yeah. So this is our highest level, and we want to integrate this with the next level. So coming down a lower level, where we're looking at identifying those micro hotspots. So this is just kind of repeating what I already said. Having more interviews. And particularly overlapping that with work on Swidden, what's going on with Swidden, because that's such a big deal in Lao, which is at the whole middle of the Mekong area. How are people modifying those forests? It's a highly forested area. How are people modifying it? And connect those two scales together, connect what we're doing with the Gigapan with what we're doing at this middle scale. Where is the biological diversity? And then lastly, looking at the actual patterns of Swidden, the plants that are in them throughout the life cycle of a Swidden, because usually people just think of, oh, you cut a hole and you grow your rice or whatever, but it continues to be used for a long time afterwards, 20 years afterwards, whatever the cycle is. And one of the problems that we see in the literature is that prominently in Southeast Asia, most of the time people are just using one word, Swidden, to refer to something that's culturally very diverse, and yet that's almost not documented at all for more than just a few cultures. Exactly what does it mean to practice Swidden agriculture within each culture, and how do they compare? What's the taxonomy of these kinds of agricultural practices? And so how are people modifying these forests into these agricultural areas and then cycling them all the way back to forest. Okay. That's my warp speed. Any questions? Yeah.
I was just wondering, if you just looked at varieties, you know, in the rice areas, how did that compare with the biodiversity of considered varieties as species?
Yeah, he just asked a good question. So he asked, if we just look at varieties in the rice areas, how does it compare? And the answer is, it flattens everything. It brings it up. So the people in the rice areas reported a lot more diversity of rice, of tamarind, of mangoes, and other things. Their brains were wrapped around agricultural diversity. Whereas the people that were living over next to the forest had much lower levels of that, and they're reporting the diversity of things in the forest. Likewise by the lake. Yeah.
Across the generations, can you generalize grandparents, parents, children, in terms of loss of knowledge, presence of knowledge, extension of knowledge?
I would say change of knowledge. Our highest measures all came from groups of children. Second highest came from grandparents. But it was because repeatedly the children took this as a competition. And the children would be racking their brains. And the children cheated. The children included things like kiwi. Now, they don't sell kiwis there, but when I went back and asked, they said, oh, it's the flavor of a candy that the kids like to eat. And the kids rapidly realized that if it's a flavor, it's probably a plant flavor. And this happened in multiple villages. We didn't have to tell them. They just did this. Old people cheated by giving us names of mythical plants. So they knew the names of plants they had learned from Buddhism. They don't exist there. They exist in India, or maybe not at all.
There's a little quote in the New York Times this morning about school change, and I think it's in New York City.
Yeah.
And the kid is quoted as saying, "It's like they finally figured out our game."
Yeah. Yeah.
So the people that are in the rice paddies, are they the same people that were before in Sweden? And how long have they been in rice? And how long does it take to lose that knowledge?
Right. I didn't actually get into it, but the original reason why we chose this spot was because these people moved here in 1894. We know exactly when they came. They keep incredible records. Their oldest records are ones on these palm leaves, but newer ones, you know, are on computers. And they know where they came from. They came from Lao, the king of Thailand, before the French took over Indochina. The king had a little deal. There's probably somebody here who knows a lot more about Southeast Asian history than I do. But anyway, there was some kind of a deal that happened, and he rapidly withdrew as many people out of Lao as he could and settled them in various parts of the Korat Plateau. The reason we chose this particular place and group of people to work with was because there was a French expedition through the plateau that documented kind of where everybody was living, and the place these people went to is reported as empty. Just huge, vast areas of forest and nobody there. And the king brought them and put them there, and so they started cutting holes in the forest. So another question that we have that I'm not presenting here is how does this knowledge that they have now compared with the knowledge of their relatives in Lao who haven't left yet, who stayed there. There's been very little communication between them over the last 100 years. And so we wanted to sample, so the grandparents in our survey were mostly children or grandchildren of people who moved from Lao. And so that was actually what we wanted to do. Was our original question for that part of the work was, you know, how quickly do people learn about biodiversity in a new environment? And we partly have an answer to that in the diversity of names. So for instance, if there's a plant that's endemic to the plateau, so they would have only encountered it for the last 100 years, oftentimes the name for it across the villages is different. They don't all use the same name. Even though 100 years ago there was only one village, and all the villages are numbered. So they know what the villages are, and they're numbered in the order of when they were settled. So we interview people in Village 2. We interview people in Village 19. It's funny. Yeah.
Your villager in Thai community to agriculture or Sweden farming in the mountain area, would you say client diversity?
There are some Putai that live up in the edge of the mountains there. There's Putai communities in other parts, like in Galicin, province. There's Putai that live more in the mountains than this group does. We actually didn't survey people who were living in that condition because I think it would have messed with our data a lot. So I don't know the answer.
And is it in the mountain area?
Yeah.
Have the highest diversity.
Right.
So I would like to know.
But they're not practicing Sweden over there at the edge of the mountain.
So is a mountain that
Yeah, it's a real forest. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, you talked a little bit about your research on the forest cover and watershed areas. Was there any kind of dramatic numbers there that you saw as far as denuding in that area? Once we see the Sweden area become really permanent farmland or crop growing, what is the future?
Are you talking the scale here in Sikonikon?
Yeah. I mean, there's like you said, there's 41%.
Oh, for the whole thing?
Was that the whole?
Yeah, that's the whole Mekong watershed. I don't think I can answer that. That's kind of beyond my speculation at this point. Maybe in a few years I could say something. But
what about in the area that you were taking a look at?
Yeah, in the area that I was taking a look at, there's actually probably not loss of forest cover, but there's conversion of what the forest is. So there's more and more rubber plantations, and those count as forest. But biologically, they're not terribly diverse nor interesting. It's an alien species from South America that's forming pretty much a monocrop. But the amount of forest cover is slightly going up because of things like that. Now, there's not oil palms being grown there for production, but that's another example where South Asia where things get screwy because there's forest cover, but it's not forest, it's a farm.
I hadn't realized that Sweden was sort of a generic term. Could you characterize some of the differences that
sure,
we might look
sure.
for? It's something I always thought it was sort of,
yeah.
only had a generic understanding.
Right. So some basic aspects is how long is the cycle? Do you come back and burn it down every 3 years, every 5 years, every 20 years, ever? Some Sweden groups only cut new forest. They continually go back and cut a new forest, a pristine forest, something that in their memory has never been cut. Now, it's likely that throughout the thousands of years it was cut before, but that's the way they do it. Others constantly go through a cycle of the same set of fields. So some other things that are different. What do you plant in the fallow? Some people plant nothing, they just rely on what naturally springs up. Some people come in and actively plant things that they plan to go back and harvest, you know, in 3 years, 5 years, 10 years. Some people actively plant trees that they want to use later. So there's a lot of variation in kind of how people tend them and how intensive they interact with that thing. Some people are pulling actually more material, and there's quite a number of studies published on this, more material out of the Sweden after they're done with their crop than they do from their crop. So it's actually more valuable to them in the succession than it is as a field. I think, Bonbon, you've been working on some of this, haven't you? What are some other differences?
Like the combination of tree or crop that being incorporated to the city.
Yeah, yeah.
Like some culture just grow the vegetable, but some culture maybe they develop kind of finally multi or complex.
So it's actually pretty complex, but in the government legislation that's affecting a lot of these countries, it's just there as a word, and kind of everybody's being treated generically. And so there's probably some cultures, in fact I'm certain of it, who are enhancing local biodiversity by doing this practice, and there's probably others who are, you know, destroying things. And it's because of subtle differences in their practices, and population differences too. There needs to be a classification, so that's one of the pieces we're working on. In the area where I showed you data, pretty much everybody has converted to settled agriculture, and they're not practicing Sweden for the most part. I'm kind of taking you down two different paths here. Just across the river in Laos, there's still a lot of people practicing different forms of Sweden, and the government has put some rules down. For instance, there was a law passed saying that you had to recycle your Sweden every 3 years, which is insane.
Well, because I guess for a lot of the minority groups, like I think it's been problematic because some of them won't admit to swimming.
Right. Yeah, you kind of got to do it on the sly. It's like your Pacalobo patch, it doesn't exist, even though it's most of your income. Oh, not yours. Sorry. I was supposed to get that away.
I was wondering if you were able to determine the percent of biodiversity that people do in their area. I saw that you put up a graph of like raw numbers with like the number of taxa they recorded, but did you look at what actual percent of what
yeah.
was there?
Yeah, out of the 2,600 and something taxa that we found, there were 76 or something, you remember? 76 that they could not put a label on and didn't seem to know anything about. And some of them were surprising. The one that was most surprising to me was Waltheria americana tribulatus. How do I describe this? To somebody who would it's a plant that's really common here in Hawaii. It's a common weed in many tropical countries. And my assumption is that it's a plant that recently showed up there. But it was kind of all over the place, but nobody knew it. And it's used as a medicinal plant in lots of places, including here in Hawaii.
Were you able to compare, though,
We have the data to do that, but I haven't plowed through it to do it.
Because that would be really interesting too, and also help us show how much of an indicator it is of biodiversity. I mean, if your area is not biodiverse, it's not that surprising if you know
right.
everything there. But then the more diverse it is, maybe even though you know more taxa, you might actually only know a small fraction of what's there.
Right. Yeah, it's a good question. We just haven't pulled it out of the data set. But I think we have it.
And then the other thing I was wondering was it sounded like you just asked them to generate lists, but you never actually showed them specimens to know if they knew certain plants.
That was the second time around we did that.
Oh, you did do that.
Yeah, they were exposed to all of the taxa that we found.
Okay.
And then generated names. And so we were then able to use those lists where, you know, there was a positive identification of the specimen to then go back and match up the data that we had.
Okay.
So
that would also be really interesting to see the percentages of people making the plants.
Right.
And to compare that to the two. When you asked them the first plants.
Yeah, I didn't really put it up there, but it's fascinating. You know, we could sit there with a stack of 2,600 taxa and multiple stacks and go through them with a person or a family. And the family would usually know 70 or 80% of what was in there. And this is the same family that would take a day. The same family that was divvied up in a group where in a 3-hour period they could only come up with a few hundred names. So they went from coming up with a few hundred names to coming up with a couple thousand names. And that's the difference between just saying, okay, what do you know off the top of your head, to, hey, here's the physical thing in front of you. And then they could all talk about it and go, oh yeah, that's a, and put a name on it.
So did that happen a lot in the area, in the agricultural areas too? Were there people who knew a lot more plants that you actually showed them specimens than they originally reported?
Yes, there were. Yes, there were. But once again, I haven't quantified to see if their percent is higher. It's a hypothesis that we just haven't pulled out of our data yet. So I don't know the answer to it. My hunch is that it's probably going to be lower in the more agricultural areas, the more intensive agricultural areas. But I don't know. Yeah.
Did you do anything in here teasing apart what plants were in their original location that they may have brought the knowledge with them versus what was completely novel?
Yeah, well, I have the data sorted that way. The problem is that I can't be absolutely certain about what is in their homeland in Laos because I haven't actually been to it. I've been to a bunch of places in Laos, but I haven't been to where these guys came from. So this is on our list of things to do in the near future. because once we've gone and done parallel work there, then we have a lot more power in addressing, you know, our original question in all of this, which is, you know, how long does it take somebody to learn? How long does it take a culture to become indigenous? It's this big, scary question. What does it mean to be indigenous? Yeah.
Does this community have a custom of forest gathering that would make certain people particularly knowledgeable about the plants once they get up onto the slopes and into the forest?
Well, yes and no. I mean, there's people getting medicinal plants out of the forest, and some of them are specialized in doing that. There's people harvesting materials for different purposes, for house construction and making tools.
And these
aren't
plants.
There's a group that make
brooms,
and so they're going to get grasses up at the top of the hills.
And they don't bother to replant them or grow them, they just go and harvest them.
Well, there's some things that are so, like when I showed the big picture I showed in the beginning of the woodlot that I said, you know, do they recognize anything here? Most of the communities have a woodlot somehow associated with them. And there are some plants that have been transplanted into the woodlot where I was told, yeah, this does not normally grow here, but we brought it here. But most of the case, it appears that there's been kind of mining out over time in those woodlots where they've become less and less diverse. That's my hunch. That's not a fact. The reverse happens, though, around each of the Wat. So at each of these temple sites, which there's a whole bunch of scattered around, people have actively planted things. And the monks that aren't young boys, oftentimes, you know, it's kind of, they have a great deal of pride in having a bunch of trees and diversity. And so they're kind of bringing things in. And as often as not, they're not from the native forest. They're from who knows where. But there's also one interesting place that we found up in the forest. This is kind of a parting thing, where we were hiking along, and it took us most of the day to get there. And we come out, and there's this little lake, and there's a little pagoda at the edge of the lake. And we sit down, we're eating our lunch, and I notice that one of the trees nearby has a sign on it that's in Latin. So I go over, and it's got a Latin name on it. I'm like, what? And then, so I ask one of the guys I'm with, I say, you know, what's the deal with this? And he goes, oh, well, they all have them. And I start looking, oh, yeah, sure enough. Somebody had just come out of the middle of nowhere and started sticking the signs. And they're hand-painted on little wooden signs, and it had the scientific name on them. I'm like, but there's just funny little things like that. Nobody could explain why somebody had done that. It was like just a stray Boy Scout project. Yes, babe. I can't hear you.
You can find the song Dracaena in Thailand.
Can I find Dracaena?
Yes. Regina. You can find the song for Dracaena in Thailand.
Chandrasara. I don't think I did collect it. Yeah. You need me to collect samples for you?
Okay.
I was just wondering if there was differences between people and how they could deal with varying specimens. Some of them just had the hardest time saying, what the heck is this thing? And I experienced that sometimes during my work. Had to sometimes go out with older people in the forest. Actually,
yeah, and inevitably, older people are able to deal with the dried, flat specimens better than young people who, you know, are not used to sorting through dead leaves on the ground. They're used to seeing the whole plant. So, yeah. But that's also why most of those interviews that we did with family groups or something. Or maybe there'd be, we'd be doing it at somebody's house and the neighbors would come over and everybody would kind of sit there and do this, and we'd eat, and we'd do some more, and there'd be people coming and going. So, I mean, keeping track of who said what is a nightmare. But it wasn't really the point to figure out exactly. I mean, we were in a village, and whatever knowledge erupted in that village.
And they could remind each other, oh, this is the one with the fruits.
You bet.
Like this.
Oh, yeah. And they did stuff like that. They'd have little arguments over it. So sometimes you'd just be sitting there while a group of people are arguing about plant, waving it around, you're seeing your really good voucher. Or people breaking off a piece and eating it.
It was so hard to get back.
Actually, that happened with the, they call hibiscus schism petalus. What's the common name for those? It's the hibiscus that's used in tea, in making tea.
Oh,
every single one of them. Yeah, every one of the arils got eaten. Just couldn't keep those. All right. Yeah.
I found that the markets often have an extraordinary variety of from
right
across the region. Did you guys spend much time in?
Yep. We did, and they had all kinds of interesting things that don't grow in the area. I mean, we collected lots of apple varieties and pear varieties and pineapple. So there's stuff coming from the north and stuff coming from the south being shipped in. They had durian there. I think we found one mangy old durian tree in one of the villages. No fruit on it. But there were four or five kinds of durian in the local market. And so, you know, people were able to give us names for durian. And they knew durian, but pretty much nobody's really growing durian there significantly. And then there were other things that, you know, people reported as coming in season, like strawberries. I mean, these guys are not, you know, isolated off in the woods. They got paved roads coming in. They take the airliner to Bangkok.
This podcast is a production of the Center for Southeast Asian Studies at the University of Hawaii. The center's director is Professor Barbara Watson Andaya. The associate director is Paul Rausch. The Brown Bag series is coordinated by Hua Lei, and the podcast series is produced by Christian Rezucas. Your announcer is Nozia Azmi. This is a free service made possible by the center, the University of Hawaii, and the United States Department of Education. For more podcasts, videos, and information about Southeast Asia, visit our website at hawaii.edu/CSEAS.